I would draw your attention this morning to the second book of Kings and the fifth chapter. The second book of Kings and the fifth chapter. This is the account of Naaman the leper. When the Lord Jesus referred to this incident in Luke chapter 4, he doesn't call him Naaman the leper, but Naaman the Syrian. And of course the Lord is quite correct. It's remarkable because he stopped being a leper. He didn't stop being a Syrian. Chapter 5 of 2 Kings verse 1. Now Naaman, commander of the army of the king of Syria, was a great and honourable man in the eyes of his master, because by him the Lord had given victory to Syria. I will pause there. In fact, we're going to consider three characters today, three very different people, different social backgrounds, different educational backgrounds. Some are powerful, some are not. Some are Hebrews, some are not. Well, one is not. And our first character, of course, is Naaman. And Naaman appears to have the perfect life. If you're in the habit of watching television and you see adverts, you will always see families, perfect families, sitting around the table, and they're happy because they've gone and bought such and such a product. And we think, I wish my family was happy like that, and everybody got on, and we sat round the table looking at each other lovingly. Or you might see somebody in your place of work and think, they've got everything sorted. They never have bad days like I have. They never fall out. They're not as ill as I am. They've got wonderful, rude health. We tend to look at other people and envy them for what they have, their perfect relationships, their perfect bank balance, meaning they have more coming in than going out, month after month after month. Their perfect retirement plan, their perfect children. You get the idea. Naaman is such a one. People look at Naaman and they envy him. Why? For a start, he's commander of the army. The word implies that he's the top dog. We'd call him a field marshal. In general terms, we'd call him a general. There you go. A free pun there. Wasn't deliberate. So, he's commander of the army of the king of Syria. Now, in an ancient country, he who commands the army is second only to the king himself. He is second in command of the nation of Syria. And at this time, Syria is a great and powerful nation. So, he has power. He's respected and trusted by his own king. There's no suggestion that the king is jealous of him or wishes to bump him off in the night. He is held in high regard. We're told he was a great and honourable man in the eyes of his master. It might be there are some people that didn't like him, but I imagine they kept their opinions to themselves because the king holds him in high regard. Verse 1 makes an even more astounding claim. And this is the reason that the king of Syria likes him as much as he does. Because by him, the Lord had given victory to Syria. Now our God is sovereign and he works through nations, he works through events, he works through his providences to achieve his will. And we know that Israel, Syria's southern neighbour, is somewhat apostate. That means that they've abandoned religious truth and they've gone after idols. And almost certainly, the Syrian nation have been God's agent or tool by which Israel could be humbled and rebuked in the hope that they would turn back to God. Naaman was used by God. Now we know that he is a pagan actually, it comes out later on in the chapter. He is a worshipper of false gods, and he's very high up and promoted in a pagan nation. And yet, the Lord used him. What could possibly go wrong? He was a mighty man of valor. That, of course, describes his character. In Great Britain, we don't always hold our politicians in the highest esteem. Although, if your letterbox is like mine right now, you'll find that a great number of leaflets are coming through assuring me of how hard-working such and such a person is. And there are pictures of people pointing at lampposts and pointing at litter. That's what they do all day. Of course I shall vote for them. And sometimes we elect people to power who lack character. Not so with Naaman. We're told he was a mighty man of valor. You certainly don't want a general who's brave enough to send his men into a conflict in which he is too cowardly to fight himself. Naaman is not such a general. He's as brave as anyone he commands, and I imagine the army respect that as well, not just the king. He's rich. He's powerful. Even God has used him. But there's a terrible clause added. But Naaman was a leper. There's all manner of speculation about whether ancient leprosy is what we call leprosy today and so on. I'm sure you can read about that in your own time. But of this we can be certain. It was killing him. We know he has an extensive wardrobe. In verse 5, he takes to Israel with him 10 changes of clothing. I imagine he had more in his own wardrobe. And he probably walked around with his breastplate and his helmet. And beneath them were robes of scarlet and purple, such as ancient generals and nobles were wont to wear. But when you took off the polished breastplate and you removed the purple robe, and beneath the linen there was a disease that was eating away at him. Preachers are very adept at likening leprosy to sin, quite rightly. In fact, I don't think the Bible ever makes that claim. But the parallels are quite remarkable. And in the 13th chapter of Leviticus, there are various ways of describing it and dealing with it. But why is leprosy a bit like sin? And when I say sin, I don't just mean a list of actions you must avoid. Oh, that's a sin, don't do that. Sin is a spiritual condition. It is an illness, and it's like leprosy. Why? Well, it goes deeper than the skin. It goes deeper than the skin. It spreads. It isolates. The Old Testament and New Testament leper was to stay away from other people lest they contaminate them. Sin spreads very rapidly from one person to another. It hinders and disables and stops people functioning properly. But ultimately, it kills. Paul says the wages of sin is death. Adam and Eve were told that if they took that fruit which they were not to take, they would die. They would be separated from God. So although Naaman has everything going right for him, and people look at him and think, he has got the perfect life. I hope my son grows up to be like Naaman. In fact, Naaman knows the truth. Naaman knows he cannot keep the riches, he cannot keep the good looks, he cannot keep the respect. Eventually word will get out. He has a contagious disease and he will die. And it might be that he prays to his gods, but they never seem to answer. It might be that he employs his wealth to summon holy men and magicians, quacks and doctors, but they don't seem to be able to do anything anyway. Although they'll charge him for telling him. This man is dying. In one respect, Naaman is a picture of us all. Now, of course, we know we haven't got those perfect lives. I don't think Naaman had a perfect life either, even without the leprosy. But sin is a condition, a spiritual malady, which is destroying each and every human being. And no doctor can offer remedy. That's character number one. Started well, but somewhat tragic. In verse 2, we're told, the Syrians had gone out on raids and had brought back captive a young girl from the land of Israel. It might be that Naaman was leading that raid. Certainly he would have authorized it. And our second character seems to be very different to Naaman. For a start, we're not given her name. Naaman is named. He is a commander. He issues orders. He is respected. He is wealthy and powerful. Here we have a kidnapped woman. She has been enslaved. The ancient world had an insatiable appetite for labor. And so she was captured, not to work in a mine or on a farm, but to wait on Naaman's wife. Even when she was free in Israel, I doubt she was wealthy and powerful, but her condition now is the exact opposite of Naaman's. Whereas he is powerful, she is powerless. He is respected, she a mere chattel. She's young, which normally would be an advantage. But her youth simply increases her financial value and the length of her future servitude. Had she been captured considerably older, we know that her forced labor would not have been so long. And she waited on Naaman's wife. She is a household servant. We don't get the impression that she's particularly mistreated. Indeed, often there was a kind of friendship between a servant and a master or a mistress. But of course it would only go so far. And the day that that girl was captured must have felt like the end of her world. We're not told that this is the case, but might she not have said, why did the Lord not save me? Why did he not spare me? Why was I the one to be taken? Why did they go for my village that day and not some other village? We know in verse 1, actually, the Lord is giving victory to Syria. So not only is the Lord allowing the state of affairs, he actually is behind it. We don't know too much of her faith, but there she is, performing menial work for Mrs. Naaman. Evidently, she is aware of Naaman's medical problem. And she says in verse 3, if only my master were with the prophet who is in Samaria, and he would heal him of his leprosy. Was that a throwaway remark? Was it a request? The master is Naaman, the prophet is Elisha. Samaria is the capital of Israel, sometimes used for the whole of the nation. So we've dealt with Elisha feeding 100 men and purifying death in the pot. We've met him raising the Shunammite son from death. But he is the topic of conversation up in Syria between a Hebrew slave girl and a Gentile mistress. And yet the words of the girl, spoken to the wife, are then shared with the husband, who then shares them with the king of Syria. The focus of the passage is very much upon Naaman and Elisha. But this girl is very special. She spoke God's truth. She was a nobody whose opinions did not count, and yet she was quoted in the very palace of the king of Assyria, Ben-Hadad II. When you speak spiritual truth to somebody, when you share the gospel, when you witness to somebody about your faith and what the Lord Jesus has done for you, you never know where it will end. You never know who is going to be moved by it, who is going to be affected by it. Did that girl know that 3,000 years later, on an island she had never heard of, we would be thinking of her? No. She could have said nothing. She might have said, serves him right. He raided my village. Now God is punishing him for what he's done to me. And that would have made her feel better. But graciously and kindly, respectfully, she tells him the truth. There's no holy man in Syria who can heal him. There's no gods worshipped in Syria who can hear him. But there is a God in Israel. And there is a man of God's in Samaria. And she has faith in Elisha, by which I mean she has faith in God. Does she know about the pot of stew? Probably not. Does she know about the miraculous feeding? I suspect not. Has she heard about the Shunammite son? Possibly. What about the oil? I don't know. But somehow, she knows that there is a true God, and that that true God chooses to work through Elisha. She also knows that the God of Israel receives Syrians as well. He's not just the God of the Israelites or the Jew. He's not just the God of those who were brought up in church. He's not just the God of the deeply religious and the theologically astute. He's the God of the leper. He's the God of the slave girl. He's the God of the nobody. He's the God of the pagan. He's the God of the one who has never shown any interest in him so far. But my, he is very interested in such a one. If only my master were with the prophet who is in Samaria. And Naaman went in and told his master, saying, thus and thus said the girl, who is from the land of Israel. Ben-Hadad says in verse 5, go now, and I will send a letter to the king of Israel. Now let's remember, Israel and Syria are at war. It might be that there is some kind of truce between them. We don't know. It would be unusual to go to a nation with which you are at war and trust them with your leading general. It might be that because Syria very much has the upper hand, that the Syrians know the nation of Israel would not dare touch him or harm him. Indeed, the king of Israel does react with fear, which we'll come to. Or could it be that even Naaman and the king somehow have faith in God? That the God who's able to heal Naaman will not allow him to be ambushed on the way back. I don't know. Go now, verse 5, and I will send a letter to the king of Israel, a letter from one king to another. So he departed. He took with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 changes of clothing. Of course, I could make a joke here about packing for holidays and all the rest of it. Let's just say he went prepared. Why does he take so much with him? Is he planning to stay for a long time? Because after all, the gods of Syria can't heal him. Maybe the God of Israel will take a long time because gods are not terribly strong. In fact, it looks like he's taking it as a payment. When he does get healed, I know I've given that away now, when he does get healed, he wants to pay Elisha, and Elisha has none of it. I'll make a greater point of that when we get there in the text, but here we have, with all the silver and the gold, quite possibly a glimpse into the spiritual state of Naaman's heart. When a human being becomes aware that they have got sin, like leprosy, and they know that God is able to restore them spiritually and put them right, our natural instinct is to offer payment. So if I am dying, but God can restore me, I look around and say, well, what can I give him in exchange? If the man of God is going to heal me, as my servant tells me he can, surely he will expect an impressive payment. I wouldn't want him, for example, to look at the poverty of my gift and think, I'll not heal you, you've not paid enough. That's what the pagan healers would do. That's what the charlatans would demand. Let me tell you this morning, you are dying of spiritual leprosy. And the God of Elisha is not here, but the God of Elisha is here. The God of Elisha is able to restore you, forgive you, heal you, and redeem you. But you have nothing he needs or wants. You could sell your home. It would not be enough. You could go and lock yourself up in a convent or a monastery until the day you die, kneeling on cold flagstones until it hurts, praying 5 times. It would not be enough. You could say, well, I'll become a pastor or a preacher. Not good enough. There is nothing we have which can come anywhere close to purchasing salvation. And so God, in his love, offers it free of charge. If you have something good that you want to give somebody, but they can't afford it, you have 2 options. Number one, you don't give it. Or number two, you give it freely. God chose option 2. The gift of God is eternal life. Don't be like Naaman. Don't take with you your bribes and your payments. They will be refused. It's also worth considering, and maybe you've been in this position as I have, when somebody has given you a gift and you've tried to give them something for it, it does cause offence. God, I think, is indeed offended when people try to buy off him what he would give them freely. So he takes his gold, he takes his silver, he takes all of his clothing, and he brings the letter to the king of Israel. And the letter, whether this is a brief version of it, or whether it really was kind of straight to the point, rather refreshingly. Now be advised, when this letter comes to you, that I have sent Naaman, my servant, to you, that you may heal him of his leprosy. Verse 7, and it happened when the king of Israel, that's Joram, read the letter that he tore his clothes. Naaman is bringing lots of changes of clothes, and the king of Israel rips whichever ones he happens to be wearing. That's not because he thinks, well, I'll have some of Naaman's instead. It is an expression of grief and mourning. He asks a question. Am I God? Am I God to kill and make alive, that this man sends a man to me to heal him of his leprosy? Therefore, please consider and see how he seeks a quarrel with me. Let's look at this from Joram's point of view. He's either at war with Syria, or they've concluded a temporary, hasty kind of truce. There is an uneasy peace on the border. And Joram thinks that Ben-Hadad is looking for a reason to restart the war. By making a totally unreasonable request. Heal that man of leprosy. If you do, I won't invade. If you don't, you will force me to invade for the insult that you have offered my house. In fact, the king of Syria, although he's a little bit terse, he's actually rather genuine and sincere. Naaman really does need to be healed. Notice also, though, that the glimpse into the heart of the pagan. The message of the girl was that there is a prophet who can heal him of his leprosy. The letter implies that the king will heal him. There is an assumption there that the prophet will do what the king tells him. To use the American expression, there was no separation of state and church. The two go together, and often in history, and indeed today, the state and religion work together. In fact, the king of Syria is rather badly informed. Elisha and the kings of Israel don't, it must be said, have a terribly good record of getting on with each other. And in many parts of the world, state religion persecutes and hounds evangelical Christianity. So the king of Israel is troubled, and yet God has sent him a gift. Imagine the future of Israelite-Syrian relations if Naaman does get healed. Imagine how his attitude to Israel might change if the God of Israel, through the prophet of Israel, heals him in Israel. He might find it a little harder to justify his program of raiding villages and kidnapping Israel's people. God has sent Joram a gift and an opportunity, but Joram is afraid and wishes it had never been happened. It never happened. In verse 8, Elisha takes control of the situation. But I'm not going to go any further. I just want us to consider and reflect again upon the three characters about whom we have been reading. We began with Naaman, the man who has everything, but was losing everything. If you have Jesus Christ, you have everything. If you don't have Jesus Christ, you have nothing. Because even what you have, you cannot keep. What you have does not last. One day, and I was thinking about this myself, one day, probably everything I own will be thrown in a skip. I would like to think that the local pastor community would come and pore over my books and divide them between themselves, and people who like model soldiers and model cars will say, yes, we'll auction that and we'll do... No, they will all be thrown in a skip, because whoever is in charge of my possessions will not have the time or the effort to faff around. The house will be sold to the highest bidder, and I will be forgotten. Oh, sure, there'll be a few of you that might remember me, and, you know, maybe in the annals of Martin Top Chapel, my name will be added to the list of ministers. And if you've got Jesus Christ, you have and keep everything. If you don't have him, you get the skip. Then we came across the little girl. Her life was ruined by that raid. She lost her friends, she lost her family, she lost her freedom. Legally, she lost everything she owned. She herself became a piece of property. And she may well have said, why? Well, we know why. Trial and tribulation, hardship and difficulty. They are all platforms upon which God will use you and help you, comfort you, support you, and be the means by which you help others. The words of that servant, had she not been captured on that dreadful day, we would never have heard of her. Just another ancient set of bones found in the soil. But she is in one respect immortalized by the text. She is the one who began the process by which Naaman became a believer in the living God. Never underestimate the quiet word of witness. Never underestimate God's ability to use trial and tribulation for his glory and for her good. I imagine when he came back, we're told his skin was fresh like a child's. When he came back, I imagine he had some good news for her as well, but we shall see. And then we have the king of Israel, Joram. I have some sympathy for him, I must say. Notice, though, he uses the word God, the general expression for God, whereas when in verse 1 we're told of how God used Naaman, we have his covenant name. Joram, the king of Israel, God's people ought to have had greater faith in his own God. There's a paradox here. Naaman becomes the stronger believer, Joram we're not so sure about. Don't see every trial and difficulty as something to fear, but see it rather as an opportunity. As something upon which you can serve God. I did hear of somebody who was ill and had to go to hospital, and rather than focusing upon the illness, rather they saw it as an opportunity to meet people in that ward they would never otherwise meet, and to say to them, you know what, there is hope. There is hope, and he's called Jesus Christ. There are three characters today, and it might well be that you resonate with one or more of them.